Students returned to class Monday in the Birmingham City Schools. Last year saw disruptions because of the pandemic, but COVID hasn't gone away. WBHM's Kyra Miles talked with one teacher about how she's keeping her classroom safe.
At Robinson Elementary School, music teacher Anna Warner plays Hot Cross Buns on the recorder, an elementary classic. She's preparing her classroom to welcome students back, and instruments line every wall, like sleigh bells on the percussion shelf, a donated piano that's missing a leg, and some vocal warm-up charts.
So, re, mi, re, mi, mi, mi.
This is only her second year of teaching, but she's wearing a bright yellow t-shirt that reads hashtag teacher life.
I'm so thrilled to see their faces again. They light up the room and they're just going to be so excited. It's going to be a little hard because I'm going to be like, okay, we have to learn the rules because you forgot them all.
Students will have to wear masks and sanitize their hands before entering and exiting the classroom. There will be no rugs because they spread germs, and students will have to play their instruments in socially distant small groups. But Warner doesn't want her students to be concerned about COVID at school.
I think all they think about is COVID sometimes. I know that's how it was, especially in the beginning for me. So honestly, trying to think about something else is my focus, like the happy things that are going on instead of the annoying or dangerous things of COVID.
Warner puts up encouraging posters around the room of kids performing, along with colorful music charts. They remind her students to have fun and
to just be silly.
This school year will bring about challenges, but teachers like Warner are ready to face them head on. Kyra Miles, WBHM.
Alabama's hospitals are under siege by the coronavirus. More than 2,700 people are hospitalized with COVID-19 statewide. Alabama could soon pass the previous peak seen in the winter. This week, the state recorded more ICU patients than available beds. This morning, we hear from Alabama physicians on the front lines.
This is Dr. Ali Hassoun. I'm an infectious disease specialist in Huntsville, Alabama. I was supposed to be off the last 2 days, but because of the surge in COVID-19, I have been working for almost 3 weeks now daily. Of course, the cases with COVID continue to increase significantly. The hospital is getting full, the ICU bed getting full. Not only the hospital base is getting full, but there's shortage of staff. There's shortage of nurses. It's very hard to keep healthcare professionals continue doing what they're supposed to do with community is not doing their part.
Hi, this is Cynthia Renee Crowder Hicks, and I'm one of the pulmonary and sleep medicine doctors here at Diagnostic and Medical Clinic. This wave is a little bit more challenging to hold up, just being honest, because it was preventable. The majority of our population is unvaccinated, and with that being said, those are the ones that tend to decline. The big thing, and when you look at the patients, they're scared and they're by themselves, so they're lonely. They have no one to hold their hands or to talk to them. The more anxious they are, the less they're able to breathe. They all cry. They are all nervous. They are all very vulnerable at that point. The majority still say, I wish I would have. And it's nothing we can do about that now. My hope is that you survive this.
You feel sorry for those who believe these misinformation. But at the same time, you see a patient is still saying there is no COVID. We don't believe there's these problems, and we're not interested in vaccination.
You know, it just blows my mind that we have gotten to this point. We've had to convert just regular rooms in a hospital to an ICU. Nobody feels that they're giving optimal care. We are overworked and we are frustrated. You know, I'm tired of my 47-year-olds dying. That was my day today. It's terrible.
Jefferson County ended 2020 on a sad note. The number of deaths hit an all-time high, including a record number of deaths from COVID-19. For people who work in funeral homes and morgues, the volume has been unprecedented. They've struggled to keep up. WBHM's Mary Scott Hodgen reports.
The Jefferson County Cemetery is a big grassy field surrounded by a chain link fence. It's the final resting place for people considered indigent or without family to claim them.
Everybody's passing due east right now.
Michael Crane is the caretaker. He digs the graves, and he remembers who's buried in each plot. There are no headstones, so Crane makes these homemade markers.
This is just a can.
He takes fruit cans, fills them with cement, and uses them to identify each grave.
And put my imprint in them. They have to be totally dry before I start stamping that.
So they need to. Earlier this week, Crane buried four people.
Today is a list of decedents scheduled for county burial on Monday, 2/8/21 at the Jefferson County Pauper Cemetery. This is Derek Wayne Jones. He's age 61. He's a black male. He's 5'9" and weighs 202 pounds. The next decedent is Antonio Palomo. He's 62.
This has become the new normal. In recent months, Crane says they've buried four people every week. It's the most that they can transport. And there's almost always more bodies waiting in the morgue.
There's usually at least one COVID patient a week, sometimes two. So there has been an increase since COVID's come about. So.
In Jefferson County, like the rest of the country, the number of deaths from COVID-19 increased dramatically in recent months. W. Eric Lusane owns a funeral home and crematory with offices in Birmingham and Hoover. He's been in the business for more than a decade, and he's overwhelmed.
Honestly, I could not fathom the numbers that we've hit this month, back in March.
Lusane says pre-pandemic, they dealt with around 70 deaths a month. In January, that number doubled. Last year, the funeral home bought a second crematory to keep up, and they hired a few more staff members. Lusane says they've managed, but it's taken a toll.
Mentally, you know, I'm not ashamed to admit it. The other day I was saying I really need to probably go sit down with a therapist. There's so much death, and you're working 12-hour days nonstop.
Deaths have increased all around in Jefferson County, not just from COVID-19. Bill Yates is the chief deputy coroner for the county.
The system as a whole has been stressed. So we have seen a surge in medical examiner's cases. Those are sudden and unexpected deaths.
Like homicides and overdoses. In fact, last year, Yates says there were probably more deaths from overdose than ever before. On top of that, the county morgue has had to store bodies for longer periods of time. The issue is twofold. For one, there just aren't many places that have cold storage capacity to do this. And then in some cases, it's taking longer to schedule burials. Yates says the morgue has been nearly full since November. But he is seeing the numbers start to go down. That's likely related to a recent decline in COVID cases. Yates says the county did not have to resort to creating additional morgue space like other states have had to do. But he says it could still happen.
One thing I am surprised is that as a whole, the industries and those who are dealing with the dead here in Jefferson County, I think we were lucky. I think that it still be possible for us to be swamped.
Yates says the county did develop a plan in case things were to get that bad, but he hopes the worst is over. Back at the Jefferson County Cemetery, that remains to be seen. Caretaker Michael Crane is still busy burying the bodies that are waiting at the morgue.
Next decedent is Daniel Hildred Nelson, a white male who is 74 years old and 6'3" tall and 200 pounds, and there was no family attending for him.
Crane says he will probably bury four more unclaimed bodies next week. Mary Scott Hodgen, WBHM.
We had a surge in the winter. Is this time different?
Yes, it is. This Delta variant is a big part of it. It's extremely contagious. It's virtually all the cases that are being seen now in Alabama. And because it's spreading so fast, just a lot of people are getting sick really fast. Additionally, we have younger people who are getting infected. And we don't have as much data as we would like right now, but it does appear that it might be making people sicker than the previous variants. So we do have young people getting sick, hospitalized, dying, and unfortunately we're also seeing some increases in cases in our children's hospital.
So what is the risk to the healthcare system? How is this different on that end versus the winter?
Well, the winter was a disaster. I mean, it was on the brink then. This is projected to be worse and perhaps much worse. I'm hoping Jefferson County and the Birmingham area might fare a little bit better in South Alabama. We do have a slightly higher vaccination rate, at least here in Jefferson County, Shelby County, but it could really be a catastrophe. I think there's a good chance we're looking at a situation in the near future where you may not be able to get a bed. You may not even be able to find space in an emergency department if you have an emergency.
You talk about the need for masking. You talk about the risk to the healthcare system. A few months into the pandemic, you did issue a mask order for Jefferson County. Why not do that now?
Well, I've certainly been thinking about that a lot. I think the question is, how do we really get to the end point? We don't have a lot of political support or popular support right now for orders. So we are, even now on this program, recommending that businesses or venues, government buildings, whoever's in charge of indoor spaces, I'm requesting that you consider putting that sign on the door to say masks required or masks strongly recommended, because we really need all the help we can get. My issuing an order, without more popular support, more political support, is going to be very, very difficult. So I'm really just begging people to help. I'm asking our business community to help. We need to all care for our community.
Well, earlier this month, you tweeted in all caps, "It's not just about you," and then wrote, "Understand?" question mark. What was behind that tweet?
Well, quite a bit of frustration, if I'm just honest with you. I had been appealing, I think, all along through this pandemic for us to look out for each other. And I'm a bit frustrated at the emphasis people are having right now on their individual rights, especially for something as simple as wearing a mask. And the fact that this is a highly contagious illness, it can't just be your own personal decision. The decision you make, whether it's wearing a mask or, avoiding crowds or getting vaccinated, things like that, does impact other people, unless you just live all by yourself out in the woods somewhere.
Dr. Wilson, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Live from Birmingham, I'm Michael Crowell with WBHM News. Tornadoes killed at least five people yesterday and caused widespread destruction in Alabama, with many houses destroyed, trees snapped, and power outages. The deaths were in Calhoun County in the town of Ohatchee, according to County Coroner Pat Brown. Ohatchee is about 20 miles south of Gadsden. During a briefing last night, Calhoun County Sheriff Matthew Wade said, "The county has been hit by tornadoes before.
We're no stranger to this. We don't like it. We don't want them. But we are blessed with good people in our county and surrounding counties."
Today, Wade said the priority is to assess the extensive damage. Matthew Condi lives in the Eagle Point community near Oak Mountain State Park. He raced home from work as his wife and 9-day-old baby hid in the basement of their home during Thursday's deadly tornadoes. He says his newborn daughter has already been through a lot.
She survived COVID and she survived the tornado so far, so she's got a lot going for her.
Conde says the storms caused some damage to his home. Water from the rain leaked inside, but he says he's fared much better than some of his neighbors. Officials say at least 60 homes in Eagle Point were damaged. Only minor injuries were reported there. As for the adjacent Oak Mountain State Park, it's closed until further notice. Officials say there's been widespread damage at the park, including downed trees and power lines. There was also damage to the park's campground and water skiing area. No injuries were immediately reported. In Centerville in Bibb County, extensive damage is reported. Trees and power lines are down, homes are destroyed, and there's reported damage to the Centerville Airport. Brian Hastings, the director of the Alabama Emergency Management Agency, says at least 200 homes were destroyed or damaged statewide. According to the National Weather Service radar, one tornado that touched down in Shelby and Talladega counties was on the ground for about 100 miles. This hour, Alabama Power is reporting about 23,000 customers remain without power.
Bobby Nelson is in his yard, surrounded by debris and total destruction. He's loading his two miniature goats into a friend's truck. Nelson says he's surprised that the animals survived. The tornado passed right through this area, off Reagan Chapel Road in Ohatchee. Nelson wasn't home when the storm came through, but his wife was. She told him the tornado lifted the house.
My wife said it picked it up and set it back down, because you can see the foundation stuff broke, the pillars underneath, busted and knocked over, and blowed some of the roof off on the back. But other than that, we were real lucky.
Four of the deaths occurred in this rural community. Three of the victims were from the same family. Many homes in the area, mostly mobile homes, are completely destroyed. A church was ripped apart. Next door, a group of family members and friends are helping Roger Norris. His house was sliced open in the back. His furniture, clothes, it's all scattered across the yard.
We don't know. We're trying to get everything out, and then our daughter and son-in-law, we stayed with them last night, and they want us to stay with them, so we're not real sure yet on what we're going to do.
Crews were out early fixing power lines and clearing trees. Nearby at the Ohatchee Senior Center, a group of volunteers started collecting donations this morning. Kathy Harvey is one of the organizers. She says the response has been tremendous.
This is a very close-knit community, like most communities in Alabama, and everybody has just pitched in.
The storms left widespread damage across Alabama. Weather officials say they're investigating several possible tornadoes. It'll take days to fully assess the impacts. Mary Scott Hodgin, WBHM.
This is a big crowd, I'll tell you.
It was Donald Trump's first visit to Alabama in 4 years.
This goes all the way back.
Thousands of people gathered at York Family Farms for Trump's meandering speech. He criticized President Joe Biden's handling of the Taliban's recapture of Afghanistan and the COVID-19 pandemic.
Biden failed totally on the pandemic, and he's now overseeing the greatest foreign policy humiliation in the history of the United States of America.
During the nearly 90-minute speech, Trump also repeated his claim that election fraud was responsible for his defeat in the 2020 presidential election. Election observers have repeatedly said that there is no evidence of widespread fraud. When discussing the pandemic, Trump encouraged the mostly maskless crowd to get a COVID vaccine, but that message was not well received.
I recommend take the vaccines. I did it. It's good. Take the vaccines. But you got, no, that's okay. That's all right. You got your freedoms, but I happen to take the vaccine.
Congressman Mo Brooks had a similar experience prior to Trump's appearance. Brooks was booed for suggesting it was time to move past the 2020 election and focus on future contests.
Put that behind you. Yes. Look forward. Look forward. Look forward. Beat them in 2022. Beat them in 2024.
When the two shared the stage at one point, Trump restated his support for Brooks in the 2022 race for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by longtime Senator Richard Shelby. Brooks also referred to Trump as a future president.
I'm pleased to announce the second coming of President Donald J. Trump.
Trump has not said if he would run, but the former president left the audience eager for 2024 as Republicans hope to take back the White House.
We will never give in. We will never give up. We will never back down. We will never, ever surrender.
In a statement following the rally, the Alabama Democratic Party took aim at Republicans for worshiping Donald Trump. Wade Perry is the party's executive director. He says Saturday's rally did nothing to help the people of Alabama.
We feel like there are real problems in Alabama that need to be addressed to help people. And we didn't hear any of that from the president or, as far as I'm aware, any of the other speakers.
That night, the crowd was also fueled by speeches from state Republican leaders, including Congressman Robert Adderholt, Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall, and Lieutenant Governor Will Ainsworth, who called for Biden to be impeached, though Ainsworth did not say for what action. Perry says Trump and Alabama Republicans should focus on more pressing issues in the state.
We need to expand Medicaid in Alabama very badly. We need to improve the economy, increase wages, and do some things that actually help real people instead of just listening to the president spew lies all night.
The Alabama Democratic Party called Trump's legacy one of sowing division among an already divided nation. Janae Pierre, WBHM.
Where's the money? That's the question many inmates are asking inside Alabama's prisons. Thousands of inmates were sent coronavirus economic impact payments from the federal government, but state officials are holding the checks. They say most inmates will get their money, but maybe not all of it. WBHM's Mary Scott Hodgen reports.
In April, a correctional officer escorted Shannon Barlow to a table at the front of Limestone Correctional Facility.
He had a check laying down, face down. I never got to see the front of it.
The officer told Barlow that the check was worth $1,400, his pandemic stimulus payment.
So I signed the check. He said thank you, it'd be posted in 30 days, and called the next man in. Very simple, short and simple.
Most inmates don't earn income inside prison, and they often depend on family for financial support. Inmates say they need money to buy extra food, soap, and to pay for things like medicine, phone calls, and doctor's appointments. So Barlow was excited to get his stimulus check, but turns out the process is anything but simple. Officials told inmates they would actually hold the checks for 60 days and maybe take out some of the money for court-ordered payments. Some inmates lost all access to their prison bank accounts. Barlow says this created chaos. He says a lot of guys are frustrated and confused.
I don't know how they're actually messing with these people's money like they are, because they ain't never did nothing like this before. And I've did almost 30 years in prison.
What's happening inside prison has a lot to do with what's happening outside, in courthouses across Alabama.
We became aware as district attorneys that inmates were receiving stimulus checks.
That's Mobile County District Attorney Ashley Rich. She's one of several prosecutors who've been filing motions to freeze and take stimulus money sent to inmates. They want it to go towards paying victim restitution and court fines. Rich says it's the right thing to do.
Why should a criminal defendant who is owed this money to a victim not have to pay this money out of a stimulus check that was given to them to stimulate the economy, and they're in prison? They can't stimulate the economy in prison.
Some legal advocates are pushing back. Ellen Degnan is a lawyer with the Southern Poverty Law Center. She's reviewed hundreds of these motions and says some inmates are not getting proper notice or a fair hearing. Degnan says prosecutors are also not taking into account the specific facts of each case. For instance, some inmates are not required to pay victim restitution until after they're released from prison. And some don't owe restitution at all. They owe legal fees.
This money is not necessarily going to victims of crime, though that is the kind of public-facing rationale for undertaking this debt collection campaign.
Alabama inmates are not the only people losing some of their stimulus money. It's happening to inmates in other states and people outside of prison with unpaid debts. That's because the most recent economic impact payment is not explicitly protected from garnishment. Yvette Garcia Misri is with the Duke University School of Law. She says this lack of protection brings up the bigger question. Who and what is the stimulus money for?
The money itself, the purpose of this was really to help people recover from this pandemic, not to satisfy criminal legal debt.
It's not clear how much money has already been garnished from Alabama prisoners or how much of it will actually go to crime victims. Prison officials say more than 4,000 inmates have received stimulus checks so far. Many are still waiting to see what happens with their money. At Limestone Prison, Shannon Barlow says his check should post tomorrow, minus a few $100s. He says he never received a court notice or had a hearing. Barlow has plans for the money. He wants to add minutes to his phone account and stock up on peanuts and rice. Mary Scott Hodgen, WBHM.
Earlier this month, dozens of people rallied at Birmingham's Kelly Ingram Park.
Hey, we're bringing the money. Back to the hood.
Back to the hood.
We're bringing the money.
Back to the hood.
The gathering was part of a national movement called Fund Peace, aimed at reducing gun violence. Organizers want Mayor Randall Woodfin and other local leaders to curb shootings by funding more community programs with American Rescue Plan dollars, the pandemic stimulus package Congress passed earlier this year. Onoyemi Williams is with the Birmingham Peacemakers, one of the groups involved. She says some of those dollars can be used to fund programs like Brothers Let's Talk, a support group for young Black men. Williams says these groups are on the ground working to prevent shootings and other confrontations.
Gun violence is just a symptom
is not the problem. The problem is a lack of resources.
Williams says the Birmingham Peacemakers have been pushing for programs designed specifically for Black men ages 17 to 34, who are oftentimes the victims or perpetrators of the city's violent crime. Participants at the rally say this Fund Peace effort is a step in the right direction. But some gunshot victims are less hopeful. Residents like Annie Brown say curbing the city's gun violence will be an uphill battle for local officials.
Because these kids have as many guns as the policemen do.
Brown lives in the city's Thomas community. Last month, the 74-year-old was eating lunch in her bedroom when at least 12 gunshots were fired into her home, one hitting her in the thigh. She says apparently the shooters wanted to send a message to her grandson.
One of the guys that was in the shooting was hollering, "This was his hood and can't nobody do nothing over here. You know, this his territory."
Territory and retaliation. Michael Coleman says that's the root of many shootings across the city. Coleman lives in Centerpoint, where he believes gun violence is even worse. At his apartment, Coleman has a room for his daughter, Journey. It's decorated with unicorns, and almost everything is purple, her favorite color.
She was so young, and that's how she used to spell. It was P-U-R-P-L-E. P-U-R-P-L-E.
Journey never got a chance to see her new room. The 4-year-old was shot in the head in July 2019. Coleman admits the accused shooter, who is his cousin, was targeting him. The two had a years-long argument over drugs and money. While confronting Coleman at his mother's apartment, he says his cousin fired several shots. One struck Journey. A few days later, the little girl died.
I would have rather died than my baby. No ifs, ands, or buts. But I know she lived 4 years for a reason. God, don't make no mistakes.
Coleman says it took the loss of his daughter to keep him off the streets and away from trouble. That's partly why he believes the issue won't be fixed by local leaders. He says it's up to those holding the guns. Janae Pierre, WBHM.
The gym at R.C. Hemphill Elementary has turned into a free barbershop and beauty salon. Students can choose a braided style or a haircut. Princeton Richardson chose a fresh edge-up.
It's just good to have a haircut.
This first grader spent the last year of school online. And his goals this year...
have fun and do great.
It's simple for a 6-year-old. It's a different story for his mom, Chariot Moore.
I do have concerns, you know, being that they say that the rising of, the COVID numbers was rising up again. So that does concern me.
Birmingham City Schools will start the year requiring everyone to wear masks. Kyra Miles, WBHM.
At 31, you're the youngest person to hold the position, but you're also the first Black woman. How does that make you feel, and what do you hope little Black girls and little brown girls take away from this new appointment?
Well, as the first Black woman, the first person of color, period, and the youngest to hold this position, I mean, I feel honored to open that door, but I also feel like I want people to realize that I shouldn't have been the first in 2021. That's a long time. The poet laureate position in Alabama began in 1930. So if you think about that, it really shouldn't have taken this long, you know. But if it has to be me to be the first, so be it. And hopefully there will be many others after. And we can sort of get the firsts out of the way and just, you know, have it be a normal thing that anyone can be a poet laureate and represent their people, their culture. And being a political poet, I'm very excited to be the poet laureate of this state, which is so often misunderstood, perhaps, politically. Not that we don't have things to work on, because we definitely do. But to hold this position, and everybody knows that I write about the real, that means a lot as well.
When did poetry become a thing for you? What's your genesis story?
I actually went to elementary school not too far from here. Like, you could walk to Epic Elementary, where I went to school. And that's kind of where it began. I already was really into books and art because my parents just let us do that all day. We were all reading by the time we were like three. But when I was seven in the second grade, there was an assignment to memorize something and bring it into class to recite. And so I had been reading that week this book called Honey, I Love by Eloise Greenfield. And it's a book of poetry for children. And it's using a very Black voice, Black settings, Black characters. So there's this poem in there called Harriet Tubman. And it begins, Harriet Tubman didn't take no stuff, wasn't scared of nothing neither. Didn't come in this world to be no slave and wasn't going to stay one either. And so I recited this poem dressed as Harriet Tubman. At the time, I had swollen adenoids and tonsils, so I was very congested. So I'm just like reciting this thing with my little, you know, nasally voice. And I just felt this surge of power that I had never felt before. You know, being an artist, you do feel a little odd, you know, all the time. You feel like you don't really fit in. And when I was reciting that poem, when I read that book, I felt just alive in a way that I hadn't before. And so soon after that day, I took what was my spy journal and wrote poems in there. And since then, I've been writing poetry.
And now, as Alabama's poet laureate, you'll kind of go back into where you fell in love with poetry in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you'll have duties including lectures and appearances at schools and universities and libraries, as you mentioned. What are you most looking forward to and what are you hoping to accomplish within the next 4 years?
I really hope that I can showcase all of the writers who are already in Alabama working. For me, it's not a matter of, you know, finding, creating, all that kind of stuff, discovering that colonial term. It's not that. It's simply me being able to tell everybody else, hey, y'all, this is what we're doing here in Alabama, or even to connect communities within the state who may not know about each other. And I really can't wait to just meet people. It always meant a lot to me as a young person to meet Black writers and see them alive and doing things, you know? And so I'm really hopeful that just by being visible and doing my best job, I can maybe let some other person, young or old, know that they can also do what it is they dream to do.
The announcement that you'd become Alabama's new state poet laureate was made a couple weeks before the release of your third book of poetry. Mm-hmm. What can folks expect?
So Reparations Now is my third poetry collection, and I'm so excited about it. I feel like, although I love all of my book babies, this book, I feel, represents me unapologetically, I guess. I felt the most myself writing this book. Not to say that I wasn't myself with the other two. It's just that with this one, I felt I have nothing to prove to anyone. And I can say now whatever it is that I want to say without fearing it, I guess. And so you can expect in this book poems about racism and the way this country was born. You can expect poems about me as a woman, as a person, about my family. There's lots of formal poetry in the book and lots of non-formal poetry in the book. And the book actually opens with a poem that I wrote for my dad for his funeral, which happened in May of this year. So there's some tenderer moments in there as well.
Tomorrow, two teams will take the field in downtown Birmingham for the girls' flag football high school state championship. The game caps a pilot season for girls' flag football, which could become an officially sanctioned sport next year. We head to the sideline with WBHM's Janae Pierre.
Touchdown, Auburn.
Pump the brakes, college football fans. This Auburn team isn't the Tigers you're familiar with.
Number 17, Lily Wellbaum, with the completed pass to number 15, Ivy Davis. The result of the catch is a touchdown.
Under the Tuesday night lights a couple of weeks ago, Auburn High School went head-to-head against John Carroll Catholic High School in Birmingham in a girls' flag football game. There's a lot of excitement with students, parents, and football fans filling the stands on each side of the field. There's a section for the band, and cheerleaders perform their routines along the sidelines. The two teams are hoping to advance to the championship.
These athletes out there, they're good.
That's Jeff Seegers, assistant director of the Alabama High School Athletic Association. Earlier this year, the central board for the AHSAA voted to make girls' flag football a pilot program this season. Seegers says the sport isn't officially sanctioned by the association just yet, but they're hoping to move in that direction.
Based on our bylaws, if we have enough member schools who are going to sponsor a team for 2022-23, we will sanction it. We won't know until probably February what that's going to look like.
As part of this year's pilot program, girls' flag football is being sponsored by the NFL's Atlanta Falcons and Nike.
The Falcons alone contributed about $150,000 towards the program to make sure money wouldn't be a barrier for any school. Seeger says those funds will be divided among schools over a 2-year period. While flag football is relatively inexpensive, there are costs.
You're looking at belts and uniforms, but you also you have to think about supplements for coaches, travel. So that can add up.
This season, more than 40 schools across the state participated in girls flag football. Mary Claire Carruth is coach of the Lady Cavaliers at John Carroll.
We have 36 girls on our team, and the ones who, you know, barely even see the field the whole game, they are in it. They're pumping their other teammates up. They're so eager to play flag football and to learn about flag football that they just keep it exciting.
The 29-year-old sees a lot of herself in her athletes. Carruth played powder puff in high school and participated in the intramural co-ed flag football team at the University of Alabama. A week after defeating the Auburn High School Tigers, Carruth and the Lady Cavs fell short with a loss in the state semifinals. She's proud of the season they've had, but she says this is just a beginning for girls flag football in Alabama.
I think that the state is surprised right now at how it took off this year, and I just think that it's going to turn into something really, really special. I think it's just going to snowball from here.
The pilot season of girls flag football will culminate with a championship game between Hewitt Trustful and Smith Station at Birmingham's Protective Stadium. Janae Pierre, WBHM. With back to school in full swing, kids at one school cafeteria get to greet a friendly face, Homer Logan, or Mr. Logan. But adults around Birmingham might know him as Logan the Entertainer, a well-known performer in the city. This morning, Logan gives us a behind-the-scenes look into his life as a child nutrition manager by day and a performer by night.
My band is on stage right now, fine-tuning everything up, and I'm just ready to hit the stage and perform for people and bring them joy, because that's what they need. They've been working hard all week, and you know, you need a great entertainer to help just bring out the best in you. Hello, I'm Logan the Entertainer, one of Birmingham's finest, they like to say. And I'm here at the 88 Club on the south side of Birmingham, where I'm preparing for a grand opening tonight. I became Logan the Entertainer. Started in 1999, I was just Logan. And I was a little guy who sat on the side of the stage asking people, could I sing at nightclubs? So I get my inspiration from being smooth like some of the greats. And one of them being Luther, Jeffrey Osborne, Hebo Bryson, Freddie Jackson. Some people say, man, you know, I remember you back then, but now look at you. You know, you just get better with time. And I appreciate people following me and noticing that I really love what I do. My dishes back here in the back. Once you wash, rinse, and sanitize, you got to put them out the air dryer. So that's basically what you hear right there. Me taking those pans and putting them up. My title is Child Nutrition Manager here at Minor Elementary School. This is a Birmingham City School, and I'm so proud to be here to take care of my little Birminghamians. I work here Monday through Friday, and I mainly gig on Fridays and Saturdays. I think about doing music full-time every day, okay? But I know I'm here. I'm in the state of Alabama. This is one of those states that's not like Vegas, you know? But hey, you create opportunities for yourself, and a lot of opportunities have been created for me. Today, we have cheeseburger goulash, all right? And we got black eyed peas today that have been seasoned real good. And we got some good old yams. They love them sweet potato yams. I love to do them like old grandmama used to make them, with the little vanilla flavor and the lemon and the nutmeg and the cinnamon and that brown sugar and some of that good sugar. Make sure they're good and sweet, and keep our kids acting sweet when everything is good and sweet. Oh, early in the morning, you know, get everybody going, you know what I'm saying? Hey, it's storming, but guess what? It's beautiful inside at Miners. My motto here is good food, clean kitchen, or you can say it, clean kitchen, good food. However it goes, both of them go hand in hand. Just like good music, just like great entertainment, just like me singing to you, and all of that stuff goes together, okay? That's what Mr. Logan says, the entertainer.
That was Homer Logan, who works at Minor Elementary School and performs around the Birmingham area as Logan the Entertainer. This audio postcard was produced by WBHM's Cody Short.